folks. My name's Todd, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Todd! We love you, Todd! Lots and lots and lots! Oh!
I hear you. Thank you. I want to start by thanking the committee for inviting me to come and show tonight. It's a privilege to be here at the first Swacky Paw.
Yeah.
So it'll take me a minute to get rolling here. And I better not spend too many minutes getting rolling because I've only got a few. I'm gonna start right off. I'm the kind of guy that always talks, that always uses the expression, I know this, I know that. And the truth is, I don't know shit.
Yeah.
But I have a lot of beliefs today. And I've acquired these beliefs through my experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of my first beliefs is that I was born an alcoholic. That's what my experience tells me. Now that I'm sober, I have a little bit of a memory and I can look back on some of my younger years and it smacks of alcoholism to me. Years before I ever took my first drink. I come from a long line of alcoholics. My mother died from alcoholism. Her father was an alcoholic. I got two other brothers that are in this program, alcoholics. And I believe I was born that way. And when I first heard about Alcoholics Anonymous in 1968, I was in the fifth grade. Giving up my age, I was in the fifth grade. And I had a teacher that shared about this fellowship that had risen up. And that was keeping alcoholics sober. And I don't know why she brought that up. Maybe she was an alcoholic, I don't know. Alcoholics Anonymous was still in its infancy in 1968. But I remember hearing that, and then I took my first drink in 1969, and it was on. And just prior to this, this is, like I said, this is 1969, and there's a lot of, you know, that whole drug culture is coming on and that, and there was a lot of public service announcements, you know, warning us against all of this. And I remember as a kid, just prior to this, swearing that I would never do that. Never. I saw, read an article once in a newspaper, and I had a guy with a black hood, and it was his story of jonesing off a smack and everything that he'd gone through, and they were protecting his identity. And I swore I would never touch that stuff. And once I took that first drink in 1969, the summer before my 13th birthday, it was on. And I availed myself of all of that other stuff immediately. All of that temperance was gone. I don't have a lot of time to go on about things. Let me just say that things escalated fast. I used to introduce myself as an alcoholic addict. That's just redundant. I'm an alcoholic. But I'll tell you what, it was that other stuff, that was my proclivity for that other stuff that kind of kept me away from Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time, because I thought that I had a problem with something bigger, that alcohol wasn't the problem. Because that stuff's noisy, you know. But all I ever did was drink. I did a lot of drinking without any dope. I never did any dope without drinking. I'm going to say that things, you know, it was fun for a long time. It was fun. Then it wasn't so much fun, and then it wasn't fun at all, and then it just became hopeless is what it became. Lines were crossed constantly. Things that I swore I would never do, you know, they were crossed constantly. I'm going to speed this up real fast. In 1983, I was arrested for my first serious charge in front of BYU. And it was a big arrest. I was charged with aggravated robbery, and it was a big deal. It made the news even, and I ended up convicted of three simple robberies, 3 1-15s, and being sentenced to Utah State Penitentiary. Yeah. And I'd like to tell you that got my attention, but that's where I went and found new dopes that I hadn't tried yet. I never got sober. I never spent a day. If I spent a day sober in the penitentiary during that stint, it was a bad day. But I was pretty good at playing the game and that, and I was paroled after 3 years and back on the streets. And in no time, it was apparent to me that I was going to go right back. So I got this great idea. Maybe I can just get out of here for a while, get away for a little bit, and I'll be okay. So I ended up in the Chicago area. And this is now 1986. and I ended up in the Chicago area. And then when I left, it was going to be 6 months, maybe a year, just get my head together, quiet things down, and come back home. I had a sister that lived in Tucson, Arizona at the time, and I asked her if I could come and stay there, and she was hesitant. She didn't want to. I couldn't understand at the time. Today, I'm grateful because I'd still be making amends to her had that happened. I ended up in the Chicago area, and I was, like I say, it was going to be 6 months, maybe a year, and I can tell you a lot happened in the Chicago area, a lot, and things just escalated, and it was about 5 years later that I came back to Salt Lake City thinking, God, if I could just get home, maybe I'll be okay, and a lot had happened, and I can tell you that all of my geographicals, but now things have gone to a point where I often joke about the fact that not only did I have a drinking and drug problem, I developed a serious incarceration problem as well. So on my geographical just resulted in a felon conviction in another state. I've got them in four other states now because I'm trying to bounce around. Because wherever I went, there I was. And the problem was with me. I came back to Salt Lake City, Utah in 1991, having stood trial for a Class X felony aggravated robbery there that I was acquitted for. But that doesn't mean that I didn't get felony convictions in Illinois. I had a bunch of possession charges and stuff. And I came back here, and I was going to get things together and quiet things down and get my shit together. And I can tell you that through these years in Chicago, there have been many times that I had sat there with my head cradled in my hands. No more. Oh, no more. Just to get up and do it again and again and again. I could not do what I was doing. I didn't know how not to do it. And it didn't matter how bad it got and how desperate and how scary, I could not do it. Came back to Salt Lake with that same idea that I'm going to get it together. I'm going to go home, get to work, and get it together. And I was right into what I was doing within 2 weeks. And I got a job, and I'm a tile. I've got a new trade. I'm doing the tile installations, and I got a job with a guy, and I'm going to work and stuff, and I get myself a place. And since I'd been convicted and sent to the penitentiary in 1983, it's now 1991. I hadn't had my own bed throughout all of this. You know, I'd just been flopping around, moving around, living in my truck, whatever, you know, staying with people. I hadn't had my own bed. Now I've got my stepmother's house was down on Third West, and it had been boarded up for years. And they said, look, you can move in here and kind of take care of the place. It'd be $100 a month. And I said, great. So all of a sudden, I got my own bed. I've got my own place. And the guy that I'd met in Madison, Wisconsin, shows up, and he says, he needs a place to stay, and I'm not really keen on having him to stay with me, but I don't know how to say no to anybody, you know, I don't have any boundaries, so next thing I know, I got this guy as a roommate. So one weekend, we go out, and I've got it down to kind of like the weekend thing now, you know, I'm going to work during the week, barely holding it together, and then the weekend thing, and one weekend, the bottom drops out for me, just completely drops out, and I call my brother. I have a brother at the time who's 4 years sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been living in Illinois when I heard that he'd gotten into AA, and I remember thinking, Christ, I hope he gets over this soon. I don't want to do it. And he had talked to me a few times about maybe checking out a meeting, and you know, you could see that I had some serious problems. So I finally called him up. I called him up and I said, God, you know, I don't get it. I can't figure it out. I do all right. And then bam, the bottom drops out again. And he says, just come to one meeting. And so I did. I finally got my attention. I was finally desperate enough that I went to a meeting. And I never introduced myself as an alcoholic, and I never really got sober, but I heard some stuff there at this meeting that compelled me to come back the next week. And I heard some stuff again, and I never introduced myself as an alcoholic, but I went back for about, I don't know, 6 weeks. And this is like November and December of 1991. But I wasn't quite ready. I was having a hard time getting in touch with the fact, thought there was a difference between what I was, this dope addict, and an alcoholic. But things got kind of good for me. And I went into Christmas, and it was probably the best Christmas I'd ever experienced as an adult. Because that year, it was a little bit less about me making sure that I had my needs taken care of first. Just that, but it didn't last long. The holidays came and I was back on it and I got away from those meetings. I'm pretty soon things are spiraling down as they do with an alcoholic. They're progressing and getting worse. And I've got to, pretty soon I don't have a job anymore because I can't go to work. I got to stay home and hang out with this guy from Wisconsin and do what we're doing. And then things get a little desperate I don't have any source of income. So the crime starts to come back up and I'm boosting stuff. I'm trying to keep it down. I'm boosting stuff. And the dope man is a fence and I can take it right to him and get what I need. And if I need something to eat, I'd have to boost that or do a dine and dash, which didn't happen very often. I didn't eat much, but, but then the day comes that I've got to give my old man that $100 for that rent. And he's not going to take a hot tool box set or a hot boom box. You know? So I get this great idea. Just one time I know what to do. I get my hands on a gun and I go, just this one time. And I go do a stick up. Just a punk ass stick up. And then that's on. Because I'm an addict and that's just as addictive to me as anything else. And so that's on. And I cannot not do it. And I knew, and I can tell you, I sat there at times thinking as this was going on and this guy staying with me, he thinks he's a tough guy and he's going to go do something. And I'm like, let's go. And then he doesn't want to. And so I'm doing it again and again and again. And I knew, you keep this up, you're going to prison for a long time. And I can remember thinking, oh, well, I don't have any choice. And jumping back out there. Finally, one night I come out from something and I almost shoot this guy because things are weird. Things are getting real weird. And I almost shoot him. And that gets my attention because, I got myself convinced that I'm just a good guy and I've got some problems and, I'm not going to hurt anybody. So that gets my attention. So I think, I can't do this anymore. So I get this great idea. Maybe I can get out of it for a while and I'll be okay. So there comes my felony conviction in Colorado. And I end up in Colorado, in Grand Junction, Colorado, because by the time I got there, I'd had some truck problems, so the money's all gone. I'm out of dope. I'm out of hope. And I end up busting for burglary and I end up in Grand Junction, in Grand County Jail. It's kind of a good thing. It separates me from what's been going on and stuff. And I'm thinking, well, this is better. What I'm doing here is better than what was going on in Utah. So I get a hold of my brother and we're starting to work out some bond. He's starting to work out a bond for me. And then all of a sudden he comes up with this little caveat. If he's going to bond me out, he wants me to come back to Salt Lake and go in this place called The Haven. And I'm like, why? I'm sober. Why do I need to do that? So I find another way to bond out that doesn't have that requirement attached to it. And I get out and I have permission to come back to Salt Lake. And my intention is to go to work. And put some money together because we're going to deal out where I'm looking at about 3 years in Colorado City Penitentiary. And I'm going to go to work and put some money together, take care of myself. I know what I've been doing this. I'm getting good at this now. I know what I got to do. And one night, my brother calls me up and I'm not doing dope. I'm drinking constantly, but I'm not doing any dope. And one night, my brother calls me up and he says, you want to come and watch a younger brother, not the sober brother, come and watch the Jazz playoff game? I said, sure. So I go to his place. I stop and get some gas and beer on the way. And when I go to his place, I drink my beer. I drink his beer, most of the fifth of Jack Daniels that his brother buddy had brought. The Jazz win, and I'm feeling good. Just feeling good. Good night. I'm driving back. I look over. I see that gas station. I get a great idea. If I was to take that gas station, that would really further my cause as far as being able to take care of myself when I go to the penitentiary. So I stash my truck, I wrap a towel around my face, and I go in and I stick this guy up. Like I say, it was just punk-ass stick-ups. And there were other things going on, but that's what it's gotten down to. I go to my truck, and I'm going away, and it's on 39 South in Maine, and I'm headed east up towards State Street, and I'm going to go to this bar and hang out. let things cool down. But when I get to State Street, the bar's still north of me, and I'm going to have to turn left, and there's an island there. And you just can't break the law like that, you know what I mean? It's against the law. So I turn right. I turn right, and I end up picking up this plainclothes detective for a Salt Lake County detective, and he's got a possible description of the armed robbery suspect. I'm sure the guy was able to say, I think he was in here earlier, and this is what he was driving, and this is what he looked like. And so he picks me up, he follows me up, and I end up on a dead-end street where my ex-wife lives. And it's got me pulled over, and I'm sitting there pulled over on this little cul-de-sac street, and I'm looking at her duplex. And he's ordering me to show him my hands and slowly exit the vehicle. He's got his gun drawn, and I don't want to do it. I just don't want to do it. I'm sick of it. Sick of it all. I'm sick of what's been going on for years. I'm sick of the hopelessness of it all, and I do not want to do it. And this seems like it goes on for a long time, but I think to myself, if I just raise this gun, he'll take his shot, and this is over. And as I am going through that, I look up, and a street light reflects back at me off of my daughter's bedroom window. It's 100 yards in front of me, and that stops me. She's right there. And I can't tell you how grateful I am. I've since learned that that's a fairly common form of suicide among white middle-aged males, and I'm very grateful I'm not part of that statistic. And I'd like to tell you that's my last drug, but it's not. I went into jail and I started doing just what I do. Because I don't have to put up with this. I know what to do. And the fellows have got me hooked up. And I haven't reached out to any of the family. I figure leave them alone. They're sick of this. You've been dragging them through this shit for years now. They're tired of it. Leave them alone. So I haven't called anybody. They're figuring out what's going on. And a few weeks into this, I get called for a visit. I'm quite surprised. And it's my sober brother. He's got a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous with him. We sit down and we visit through glass, and he reads me the portion about the jaywalker, and we talk a little bit. We cry a little bit, just a little. I'm not ready to cry yet. I haven't cried for real in years. I go back to my cell, and we've been cooking off some tomato jack. You get a little sugar, yeast, some tomato juice, throw it in the shower for a little heat, and it ferments up a little bit. It was divine. Lovely stuff, let me tell you. So we're having some sophisticated cocktails in the third tier of the old Metro Jail, and I've worked out a deal with the prosecutors. Either I've just taken a plea or I'm about to take a plea, and I'm pleading guilty to a 5-to-life first degree felony, and they're going to drop everything else. And I'm looking at a minimum of 10 years. That's what my matrix calls for. Get you down from 1-5 to life and your minimum of 10 years. And I'm thinking about that, and I'm thinking about my brother's visit, and a thought comes to me. I can do 20 years. It's not going to matter. This has been going on for years, and if I don't do something, it's still going to be going on. It's not going to matter. So the next thing I know, I got this feeling of hope, and I'll never forget it. It's the most profound moment of my life. Maybe I could get sober, get through what lies ahead, and have a life someday. I get goosebumps right now as I tell you that. And I'll never forget it. It's the first time I ever felt hope like that in my adult life. The next day they broke out the tomato jack, and I said, I'm good. I don't need any. And as far as I know, that was May 7th of 1992. It may have been sooner, but it was at least by that date, and I haven't had a drink or a drug since. Yeah. As I said, I'm a guy who has beliefs, and this is one of my most fervent beliefs, that were it not for Alcoholics Anonymous, that would not be the case. That's what my experience tells me, that my sobriety is a result of Alcoholics Anonymous and finding a power, an all-powerful and loving God, higher power that I call God today, because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Another gift of AA, my greatest gift. I ended up doing a fourth, fifth step with a complete stranger in the mock closet on the third tier, just because that's how it happened. And I don't know where that thought came from. I don't know where that hope that I first felt came from. And I don't know when all that crap that I used to drink and use over that was coming up because I'd swore I didn't want to drink or use anymore, and that crap was coming up, and I knew something was going to give, either because violence is a good way to avoid it, hurt myself, hurt somebody else, use. I knew, and I had this intuitive thought to talk to somebody, and I ended up talking with a complete stranger, and it was a half-assed effort, but at least I was telling the truth to somebody, because I couldn't look at this stuff. I couldn't look at it. It was like I was going to fall into a bottomless pit, and for years now, I had done anything to avoid looking at that truth. And then, and finally, I walked through it. I don't know where that came from. I don't know where that hope that I felt came from. I don't know where the sense of freedom that I had 1 year into this life sentence came from. But I remember it profoundly, and I felt free. And today, what I believe is that it was my higher power doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I wasn't giving credit to that higher power, because I didn't come in here with God in my back pocket. I didn't come in looking for God. And my story is not one where I found Jesus in the jail cell. That's not my story. It's just not. I struggled with that. You know, so when it came to the first step, I surrendered the fact that I was an alcoholic finally. When it came to the second step, I felt that hope. And when it came to the third step, I just made a decision to do whatever I could to do what you guys were doing, because it seemed to be working for you. You know? And that's how I got through those steps. I was paroled after just 5 years because of my sobriety. And I know that. And when I got that date, I went to the board after 3 years, and everybody assumed that they would continue me for another 3 or 4 years and then hear me again. And they came back with a 2-year date. And that's when I got a glimpse of something happening, because I'd been living my life differently than I ever had for those 3 years. Words like trust and integrity had meaning to me. You know what I mean? I quit worrying about whether people would see what I was doing and just do what I was doing. And it wasn't about impressing the board, although I wanted to notice it was, but it wasn't just about impressing them. It was about the rest of my life, and that was the truth, and they got a sense of that. And when they came back with the data, I got a sense of something. But it was gradual. It was slow, and I got a sense of something big. You know, I'd done a little schooling and stuff, and I had an idea that there was bigger stuff out there than just my existence. Because I was the guy that I used to use the expression, oh, thank God. But it was a figure of speech, because what I meant was, thank God. Because I thought it was all about me. And I did that for years. Even when I started to look back on how I had kind of stumbled into the AA program before I knew I was doing the AA program, I thought I was just a smart guy figuring this stuff out like Bill and Bob. You know? It took a while, and I can tell you I was paroled after 5 years, and I walked out the gates happy, joyous, and free for about 3 months. But I left there thinking I did it, I made it, I'm good to go, I don't have to do this stuff anymore, I can get on with my life. And that's not the case for me. I'm an alcoholic. I'm just as much an alcoholic today as I was the day I was born, the day I took the first drink, the day I took the last drink. And all of that stuff, that alcoholic head, started coming up for me because I wasn't doing anything about it. And I was full of loneliness and self-pity and anger, and I had all this opportunity going on. And I'll tell you what, one time I'd been in the hole, in a dark cell, and I sat there and I realized you took everything in your life for granted. Everything in your life, the big stuff, the little stuff, everything in your life for granted. If you ever get another opportunity, remember this. Remember to smell the roses. And I was sitting out there a few months after being paroled, and I couldn't smell the roses. And it scared me. And I thought, I'm just one of those guys that does well in the institution. You know? And it scared me. But I was going to this meeting that I'd gone to in 1991 every now and then, but I'm a social derelict. I don't know how to talk to anybody. I'm full of fear. I'd go to the meeting, and at the end, I'd leave. I'd run away, go home, isolate, go back a few weeks later, desperate again. I'd leave, run away. Finally, 1 week, I couldn't stand anymore, and they opened up the meeting, asked if anybody wanted to come up and share, and I walked to the front of the room, and I was scared, really scared, which is kind of funny given how my life had been prior to this, but this had me scared. And I walked up to the front of the room, and I introduced myself to all of you, told you a little bit about myself, and something happened. And after that meeting, you came to me, and you welcomed me. You handed me my first chip. It was a 5-year chip, because we didn't have chips in the penitentiary. I've been doing AA, but we didn't have chips. Handed me my first chip, brought me a few phone numbers, and I felt something. Felt a sense of belonging. Felt like I'd finally arrived. I found a place. And so I called my brother, and I said, they got more than one meeting a week out here? And he goes, oh, yeah, they do. So I ended up at another meeting on Friday night. I'll never forget it. It's a no-nonsense group out in Sandy. And I felt that same sense of relief, that same sense of belonging, that same connectedness. And I remember standing outside of that meeting, and it's November now or something. It's kind of a cool evening, and I'm standing out there, and this thought occurs to me. I'm going to have to do this shit the rest of my life. And I wasn't too thrilled about it at the time. I'm going to tell you, I really wasn't. But I surrendered to that just like I surrendered to the fact that I was an alcoholic. And I'm so grateful. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's given my life meaning, a sense of purpose. You know, I was one of the guys that I had a hard time getting sober because I thought if I can't have a beer, if I can't even have a beer, just kill me. This life is going to suck. What's the point? If I can't even have a beer, if I'm so derelict that I can't even have a beer, just kill me. This life is going to suck. Being sober is going to be boring, dull, and glum. And I couldn't have been more wrong. It's been anything but. I couldn't have been more wrong about sobriety. You know? And then what it took is it took the day when being sober, when my perception of being sober was worse than what was really going on. And thank God that occurred. I wouldn't be sober if it weren't for Alcoholics Anonymous. Like I said, I really believe that. If it weren't for the steps, I have been able to discover things about myself that are appalling. But thank God I get to discover them, and I do that through the steps. Right? And I am still discovering stuff today because I thought I had it. I thought I was good to go and had that ego way down 10 years ago. Now I don't know how you guys put up with me. Thank God I get to grow that way. I'm becoming the man I want to be. I'll never get there. Because this is my belief, another belief of mine. There is not a human on this planet, nor has there ever been a human on the face of this earth that is immune to being human. You know what I mean? And I make those human mistakes, but at least I don't have to make them in an alcoholic manner like I used to. You know what I mean? Sometimes they're a little alcoholic, but nothing like they used to be. And I've got Alcoholics and all of you to think. Thank you for that. As I said, I'm going to wrap this up because I know I'm going long. I've got a lot of gifts, a lot of gifts. I've got material stuff. I got a house today, you know. It blows my mind. How did this happen? You know, my neighbors like me. I got a car. I don't know how that. I pay insurance, you know. I still think utility companies are going to have a party on my behalf to thank me for paying my bills. You know. But the greatest gift I've gotten from Alcoholics Anonymous is, like I said, is that higher power. That is the greatest gift. And the second greatest gift is all of you. Thank you so much.